Welcome to La Nina, the only podcast forecasted to make two major landfalls this year.
Some people will suffer, some people might die.
I'm Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 3, Episode 5, entitled Chapter 31, as is the custom with House of Cards. What'd you think of this episode, Aaron?
I thought it was really good. House of Cards started to kind of lose me in the last episode.
Yeah.
Wasn't sure where we're going from the Jesus moment. Mm-hmm. Answer is pretty interesting things. We got major movement on almost all fronts. We introduced some interesting plots. Mm-hmm. Freddy's
back, baby.
He's back with the promise of ribs to come.
Yes. If they don't assign him a job where he can cook ribs, what are they doing?
I'm telling you, Freddy in the White House as White House cook. Uh-huh. This is a done deal. This should just happen.
It should have happened a long time ago.
He should be the first employee of the United States.
He should be the one behind the desk saying, no, I want 250 and 3 points of ad sales. Like, he should be in Stanford's position with Frank.
I want 3 points per rib bone, Frank. I won't accept a penny less.
Seriously.
I have a certain set of skills, Frank.
there's a lot to love about this episode. Halfway through, I was a little worried that, like, maybe we were jumping the shark a little bit with House of Cards, with him trying to ram this work act through by basically presidential order here and creating states of emergency. And it got a little crazy, but at the end, they brought it around so well with Claire's involvement.
There's a natural ebb and flow where Frank schemes, people counter scheme. He looks triumphant. Yeah. He looks down and out. This is like a Frank and Claire triumphant episode.
Frank and Claire.
Frank and Claire.
Frank Bolts. And Claire's monster.
Sure. Going into the Frankenstein well again.
I am. Sorry. I didn't even watch Frankenstein recently.
So this episode is directed by James Foley, who is a famous director. You might have heard about some of his things. He directed Glengarry Glen Ross.
Oh, hell yeah.
His personal philosophy is always be directing, ABD. he also directed The Chamber, which is a novel adaptation from the John Grisham novel of the same name. He's got a lot of television credits to his name as well. This was written by Kenneth Lynn, who wrote episodes for Twin Peaks and recently Hannibal and House of Cards, the last two seasons. He wrote 9 episodes of House of Cards. So he's all up in, all upons. Let's talk about this in pretty much storyboard fashion or topic fashion. Let's start talking with the AmWorks, America Works.
All right, sounds good.
We kind of get a glint. We start the pieces start coming together. He is in cahoots with the mayor of DC, which was kind of brilliant because it's its own independent thing, and it doesn't have a governor or any kind of legislative bot that he has to ram through.
Yeah.
It's just a dude that has to declare an emergency and he can jump in on it.
And apparently he's all on board this plan.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not totally sure why, though. Does he just want more jobs for the community? And
well, like, yeah, I don't know, because my idea of the mayor of D.C. is colored by Marion Barry, who is the famous whore hound, coke crack smoking, cocaine sniffing mayor of D.C. Mm-hmm. That's probably an unfair characterization of the job, but my idea of it is kind of like a maverick. He's like Clay Davis on The Wire. It's like, you know, someone want to give him $3 billion. Shit, is he supposed to say no? You know, that's
sure.
The feel.
Yeah, no, I get you.
So if motherfuckers want to hand me $3 billion, and I'll take the $3 billion. That's what I'm getting from him.
All right.
And like he says, you know, it's like it's a scrappy bulldog that you want. It's like he's got. Yeah. He's
well,
got
at
more
least when,
power.
At least when they're working in your favor. Like, he would say the same about Heather Dunbar if she was helping him out, you know?
Sure.
Yeah, when they're working with Frank, he likes him. Sure.
Right. But he says, like, you know, it feels good to be on the tack, and honestly, it's a good look on him. Mm-hmm. My favorite line of this episode was, if they won't let me scrape the money behind the scenes, I'll rob the bank in broad goddamn daylight. really good like stuff. That. You had a point here where he's talking to Claire and he does the broad goddamn daylight where you notice the invisible doors.
Yeah, the ones that blend into the wall surrounding them. And they're obviously meant to be noticed as doors because they have doorknobs, like giant honking doorknobs.
Yeah, you would think that if you're going to hide the door,
hide
why
the
not,
fucking door.
Not have like if Tesla automobiles can have like a flush latch that only pops out when it's needed, you'd think the president of the United States can put something like that together.
You would think so, yeah. So I don't know what those doors are for, but they always like just frame it up and make it a door. Come on.
I figured that they're like servant access.
Okay. You know, I bet the like president the has a lot of workers that like, work for him.
Like that goes
like
directly.
Every amenity
yes.
is taken care of in the White House.
Yeah, like those things go right down to where the scullery maids and the chefs and the bowels of the White House where all the stuff happens.
It's basically Downton Abbey in America.
It's Downton Abbey except for you can also launch nukes.
Sure. Yeah.
And
if
your
you
body,
want to.
And your butler carries machine gun.
And apparently you can declare the war to make them legal, to make the launching of the nukes legal whenever you want as president. Send some troops in where you know it'll piss somebody off. They retaliate right. And you declare war.
So the way this plays out is the mayor of Washington, D.C. Says, folks don't have jobs. I got 60,000 unemployed people right here in the nation's capital. It's a disgrace. I'm declaring a state of emergency and asking for $3 billion. Mm-hmm. We see the Republican or the Democratic minority leader on a treadmill saying, motherfucker. Yeah. And Congress is pissed.
I think he's on an elliptical. If he was on a treadmill, he would have fallen off. Just face plant.
We have full bipartisan support that they're committed to destroying this. And Frank's position is kind of like, come get me.
Yeah.
You try to pass legislation making this run explicitly illegal. I will veto it, and then we'll let the Supreme Court decide.
Yeah.
And somehow Grandpa Justice is going to... Jacobs is going to factor into this, right?
He's got to. He's got to.
There's
got
to be some kind of grand manipulation left.
Do you think... Okay, so I was going to ask you, which way do you think that will go? In favor of Frank or against Frank? Because it could also be that, you know, he tried to pressure him out of his seat prematurely, and the guy resents that now and won't work with him.
Well...
Could be part of his downfall.
It seems like in modern history, the Supreme Court has split like 4-5 on any... issue of note. Mm-hmm. You've always got like 4 conservatives, 4 liberals, which blows my mind when you're talking about reading law. Like, what does your personal views have in interpreting the constitutional laws? But it does.
It does.
And you've always got one guy who's quote unquote neutral, and he caucuses liberal or conservative depending on the issue of the day.
Where the money's going.
It seems like if Jacobs is like a liberal justice, which it seems like he is, and he would be one to be opposed to this grab of power by the American president, that I wonder if Frank is going to somehow dismiss him and then use his presidential power of hand selecting someone that he knows will back him. Mm-hmm. Now, how he gets that through the Congress, I have no idea. Like, there's a lot of moves I can see him making, but he's doing a lot of ramming through Congress.
He is. I mean, he's ready to declare war to get stuff through.
It's interesting commentary on the president of the United States because the unprecedented power grab that has gone on with the presidency since essentially the Civil War, but it's really ramped up since World War II, is just amazing. Like, every president, it seems like, you know, whether you like him or not, takes that power a little bit further, does executive orders a little bit more sweeping and broad and legislative. Mm-hmm. And then if he doesn't like a law, he can just not enforce it. It's super powerful.
Yeah.
He's kind of in charge of declaring war anymore nowadays, which.
Yeah, man. It's
everyone says it's a problem, but anytime it happens, nobody seems to care. I think there's a lot of smart commentary on what's going on with American politics going on.
Oh, yeah.
In House of Cards.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm not super up on the political stuff, but I enjoy watching it.
Yeah. So we've got also a subplot where Alia, what's her name? Alia?
Ayla was the former reporter.
She's dismissed, which was kind of a minor crowning moment of awesome for, what's his name? It's not Gavin. Seth.
Yeah.
And we see that has kind of backfired because now her mentor... her name is Kate. I got it written down somewhere. I'm not really sure.
Kate Silva is what you said.
Kate Silva. She is coming in here and she's saying, like, look, you can't dismiss two of us in a row.
Yep.
I am like qualified to hell and back, and I'm committed to making your life miserable.
Yeah, and she does it with two front page stories of information that they didn't even know was out there, let alone would want.
She instantly digs into like a little thing that happens in the very beginning of the episode is a casual mention that the Department of Homeland Security has recently been vacated.
Uh-huh.
But it hasn't been released publicly. She tears into that.
Mm-hmm.
That guy very smartly doesn't comment publicly, but turns him over to Barney, who is the FEMA administrator that Frank strong-armed. And yeah. Use the fact that you are an honest civil servant, and you might not like what I'm doing, but if you, and this hurricane stuff might be risking people's lives, but if you leave and protest...
Yeah, you'll be endangering lives because someone far less experienced will jump in and take your place.
And what's brilliant about that is Frank's like, I don't care. I'm willing to play ball with people's lives, but I know you're too principled to get down here in the mud and wallow with me.
He's going
to
do the same thing. The guy's going to be on his deathbed, and Frank's going to be down there. If you die, these people, they're going to be hurt. And it'll give him one last gasp.
So we've got, and this is also very topical, you know, we're in the middle of a La Nina cycle, and they're predicting two major hurricanes.
Mm-hmm.
Although, I gotta say, I feel like that Frank is right. He can take this $3 billion and spend it in this one location as a test bed for his plan. And if there is a hurricane, there's no way Congress denies him funds just to be petty.
No, you're absolutely right. The thing I think he's concerned about is the delay in time responding to the hurricane. Caused by needing to ask for money instead of having the money ready to go.
I guess that's true. And they do make that point. So
yeah, that's probably Frank just where his head's care. At. Yeah, no, Frank's like, fuck it. Yeah, I'll endanger some people's lives.
We're going to get Katrina 2.0 here.
I've killed people. I have directly killed people. What do I care if more people's lives are in danger?
So that's the main plot of Amworks. But I thought the selling of the Amworks was another good thing to talk about as it's kind of his own unit. And we get the mm-hmm. fact that Frank, you know, he's a video gamer. We've seen him play Call of Duty before.
Yep.
He's moved on to casual games.
Monument Valley, yeah, one that I've definitely heard of.
Was it Monument Valley? I thought it was Princesses. What was it, Secret Princess? Silent Princesses.
No, that's what you play as. That's the character you play as.
Oh.
He's playing a game where he's a silent princess.
And it's called Monument Valley.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. I've never heard of this game.
Okay.
It looked kind of like Captain Toad's Adventure from like one of those puzzle, three-dimensional puzzle games.
Yep. I love the description that the writer, that Mickey Doyle gives of it in his review.
Was
like M.C. Escher as like the likes of only which M.C. Escher could have even dreamed.
Right.
Or some shit.
So speaking of him, Mickey Doyle, played by Paul Sparks, he's one of our... I wouldn't say favorite characters, but a guy you love to hate on Boardwalk Empire.
Oh, yeah.
He's the guy that goes, he is playing the role of author Thomas Yates, who's recently mm-hmm. wrote a presumably bestseller called God's Cauldron.
Yeah.
And another book called Scorpio. And apparently he also used to write for video games, or he is writing reviews of video games. Highfalutin video game reviews.
As a best-selling author... Do you go to write video game
Is he doing that for
reviews?
Kotaku? Is he doing that for Polygon?
Somewhere smaller, like is PlayStation this, Magazine or
is
something.
Is this like when Hunter Thompson started writing for ESPN's Page2
mm-hmm.
.com when he was kind of in the twilight of his career? He's slumming, essentially.
I think so.
He's got an idea of how to sell this, and he brings him into his office. And he pitches it as like, I want you to do as good a job selling Amworks as you did selling the video game. And he's like,
yeah,
I wasn't trying to sell the video game. I was talking about my experience. And he's like, there you go. I want you to tell my story. It just so happens he brings him in on the day that they set up the tent right outside in the National Mall.
Just so happens? Or do you think he planned that?
Oh, no. He planned it.
Okay.
On the 4th, I believe on 4th of July weekend.
Yeah, it is.
And it's right there in the National Mall, and you can see just people lined up to sign up for the job initiative. Frank's got fireworks and stuff going.
Mm-hmm.
I think with this Thomas Yates, he's basically offering him an all-access pass to tell whatever story he wants, with Frank thinking it's going to be a good one.
Mm-hmm.
It reminded me a lot of Bobby Knight giving a reporter access to write what eventually became known as the book Season on the Brink.
Okay.
And he was fine with it. And then he read the book and he was furious. I mean, it by all accounts is a very accurate tale of what Bobby Knight is like,
uh-huh.
coaching, a former coach of IU basketball, Indiana University Hoosiers, during, I think it's the 84 kind of semi-disaster season, or maybe it's 85, the year after they won the national title. But the thing is Bob Knight is kind of a dick and kind of an asshole, and telling a truthful version of that story involves outing the fact that you're kind of a megalomaniacal asshole.
Yep.
I think this is where this story's heading.
It has to be, right? Where else does it go that it is interesting?
Well, when Frankie says, you know, journalists can't resist telling a story and politicians can't resist making promises they can't keep, this is basically setting up massive conflict.
Totally.
Yeah. And I don't know how he...
It's transparent. It's a little too transparent.
I don't know how he stops Yates from telling a very unflattering story. Because Frank is a dick and an asshole.
You're right. You're right.
And a megalomaniacal person.
And I think if this Yates guy understands Frank in any relevant way, he's going to know that. I don't think Frank can fool him. How about this? How about during the course of investigating him for this book, he uncovers the Rachel stuff?
Good.
Is that interesting?
If he documents his rise to power, like,
yeah,
Frank,
like,
these
dots aren't connecting. What's going on here, Frank?
Frank is inviting him to look at all the skeletons in his closet. So
all the ones that he wants to show him, but I think he's going to find more.
Is he going to interview his personal bodyguard, Meacham?
The Threechum's got to be in that book, right?
Yeah.
If it's not in there, it's a huge oversight.
Speaking of amenities of the White House, if you're like chief bodyguard, you got hot and cold running pussy and penis on tap just whenever you – I mean, there's some stuff there, right?
Sure.
I loved at the end of the episode, in the dark, everyone watching fireworks, like, you know,
yes,
standing in line for this kind of entitlement handout, whatever, is patriotic.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank is over the loudspeaker giving a speech, and it's very like 1984, V for Vendetta,
Half-Life 2,
like any Big Brother government thing.
Dystopian, yeah.
That was intentional, right?
It's got to be. It's got to be.
The blatant propaganda with... I mean, the only thing that could have made it better is if there was giant posters of Frank's face.
Yes.
Or a view screen.
Or him, yeah, him on a TV. Yeah. An extreme close-up. Sure. I really like that imagery. I don't know where you're going from here, but I kind of want to talk about...
Freddy.
Okay. All right. That's a perfect place to go.
Because he's in line.
Sure.
And he is Freddy. He's still
he's in line and he's Freddy. All right. The
That's
two
right,
things
Frank.
That we need to know about him
That's
at this
right.
moment.
So if you don't remember, he had a deal to make a national chain of Freddy's restaurants. And he was going to cash out. And he had a son who had a little bit of criminal background, and Freddy himself had some criminal background. This son, in the kind of like intense scrutiny that Frank had brought on their relationship, because he used him to cater several things, and you know, we know how involved they were with each other. Frank had to distance himself from him. At the same time, this intense media scrutiny caused his son to brandish a weapon at a reporter, which triggered the morality clause of his restaurant deal. He had to sell his original restaurant to bail his son out of jail. And then he lost the contract because of the ethics clause.
God damn it.
Now, a lot of people, when I was reading the wiki to kind of refresh my memory, number one, watch that, because the Wikipedias are all updated with new information, and I came perilously close to reading a spoiler.
So did I. Like, paragraph one is safe. Paragraph two, oh shit.
Yeah, yeah. And
spoilers.
And there's not like marked for season three. It's just like, here's what, and I'm like, oh God, you got to be careful. But the Wikipedia's consensus was that they had a falling out. I remember on the podcast, and my personal recollection is not that Freddie was angry with Frank. It's more like, I know you got to do what you got to do, and I ain't going to accept handouts. Like, Frank wanted to help him, and he didn't want that help.
And yeah, you're right about that.
Him saying, you're nothing more than a good customer, I thought was his kind of manly way of telling Frank, I'm not going to embarrass you. I'm not going to give them anything to use. I don't think that they ended on... Well, I mean, they're not ended on friendly terms, but they didn't end as like some kind of bitter enemies either.
I don't feel like they ended as bitter enemies. I felt like there was some hurt and anger in that statement from Freddie that, you know, you've always just been a customer or whatever. That to me felt like him saying, you've offended me, you've hurt me, you know, just letting him know, not saying he's going to necessarily hold that against him forever, but definitely like a little bit of betrayal in his voice there, or his words.
Where do you think it's going to go now? Because I have
no idea. Yeah, that's the thing. Like, I don't know where that gets us with Freddy. I feel like that was just a teaser. Like, hey, Freddy, remember
it's going to be like Morgan. We're going to see him again until the season finale. And coming soon on season 4 of... Okay, so anything else you want to talk about Freddy, or should we move on to the Jordan Valley?
Yeah, that's what I want to talk about.
This is the other fork of the dilemma that Frank has got. We're starting to understand what this is about. This is about the literal Jordan Valley, which is the episode helpfully tells us is a piece of real estate 10 miles wide by 40 long, which is hotly contested in the it's a linchpin to making peace between Israel and Palestine. The plan calls for U.S. peacekeepers to deploy to the area, which will allow Israel to withdraw strategically while the United States keeps the peace. Palestine move in as essentially this is going to be somehow some path to statehood. And with the U.S. there assuring that the Palestinians are not going to use that land to stage attacks on Israel. That's what I'm gathering is what this is all about. What I thought was cool is this is essentially like Dan Carlin worldview 101.
It is.
And there was this brilliant scene where they had a foreign policy advisor briefing. What's her name? Heather...
Dunbar
on like why this is the real politic of this. And he scanned the map just a few miles away and said, this is what this is all about. This is people don't realize this, but this is right on the border of Russia.
Yep.
And just like we wouldn't be huge fans of them deploying Russian troops to Panama or any place in the whole Western Hemisphere.
Sure.
Russians are not big fans of us deploying several thousand troops within marching distance of Russia.
Yep.
And I like the fact that they are actually showing why, you know, I think in the United States, a lot of Americans get the, you know, like Putin's evil, Putin's crazy, and he may very well be. But opposing U.S. expansion in the Middle East and Eastern Europe is not insane from a Russian, hey, this is our sphere of influence.
Sure, yeah.
And if they did it to us, we wouldn't allow it. I mean,
no,
fuck.
Certainly not.
Watch the movie 13 Days to find out what happens.
Yep.
when all this...
put missiles near America.
Right, which was, that was the thing. Like, we put missiles in Turkey, which made Russia put missiles in Cuba, and we're like, oh, what the fuck?
Yeah,
so it's like that's happening again.
It really is, and I mean, if you want to hear
real life,
in real life and the show, it's very much mirroring what's going on right now.
Yeah,
with politics with Russia. I thought that was great to see as well. I think a little more context on the broader world scale is good for everybody.
Yep,
myself included.
Indeed. And also but, another stuff is like Dan Carlin 101 is when Claire was trying to strong arm the Russian because the Russians are now, you know, they've kidnapped the gay rights activist.
Yep.
They're threatening to arm Iran. And she's like, if you do that, we'll put economic sanctions. And he's like, that might work with China, but we only get like 5% of our exports depend on the United States and Europe needs us for our natural gas. So fuck you and your economic sanctions.
Yeah.
You can't make them stick.
We're holding the cards.
Which is all true.
Yeah.
And Claire's like, oh.
But then I guess her plan is to go ahead and put troops in there regardless because that's what Frank can do.
So, yeah, the Israel – this Israel and Palestine are pulling out because Israel's afraid that they were just going to pay lip service to this and then not actually do it.
Yeah, and that's a big problem for her because she's trying to block the Russian veto in the U.N., Of these troops going in.
So her idea was to go to Francis and say, can you give me an executive order that guarantees that you will give X amount of troops to any UN resolution passed? Which is something that he said, well, you know what? That's going to piss off Congress, but they're already pissed off. So, which I kind of like. Like, there's a peak amount of outrage and vitriol that people can pump out to you every day and people absorb. Mm-hmm. So when you're at, like, you know, 10% approval rating and Congress hates you, why not keep trying to make swings at the baseball, you know?
That's the thing. So I
try to hit a home run.
I was thinking during this, man, I don't know if he has the public opinion available to him to do this. But ultimately, it doesn't matter if he's not being nominated for re-election next time, right?
Right.
So he's either going to make this all work out, his public opinion is going to turn around, and he's, his plan to force these guys into nominating him,
yes,
or running against them anyway, as perhaps another party or something, is going to work.
It's yet another.
And if this plan doesn't work and public opinion tanks, it doesn't matter because he was never going to get elected anyway.
Exactly. This is once or twice an episode, or once or twice a season, Frank Underwood puts all of his chips into the table.
You're right.
And almost he's the only one willing to do all that.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's betting that he has the best hand of cards out of all the people with the testicular or ovarian fortitude mm-hmm. that can put their chips in the pile with him.
Yeah.
And so far, he's always been right.
So far. Now, if this is potentially the last season, I don't know. We might see him fail spectacularly. That's the thing that's really making it interesting for me this year is I don't know if this has another year. I don't know if he's going to survive this season even.
Yeah, like other seasons, we've always thought that he was going to win somehow.
Yeah.
And it's still been fun to watch him. But this season, I'm always waiting for the worm to turn.
Yeah.
And it's added a little bit of spice to the watch.
Definitely.
One of the pleasures is the Russian ambassador who's been... I mean, the Russian president was super insulting to Claire. Mm-hmm. He's been... I thought he was fairly respectful in previous episodes, but she's been kind of strong-arming him. So he took this opportunity of like, we ain't afraid of your, you know, warmongering. We're not afraid of your economic sanctions. Fuck off, to add a little bit of, you're no more qualified to be an ambassador to the UN than I am the first lady. And also, nice dress, by the way. Such a dick move.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know what? She paid him back.
When she
with
met him.
With a shit meeting.
When she met him in the John, or in this case, the Jane. And he starts it off with applying makeup and like, oh, do I look pretty?
Oh, yeah. No, I love it.
Can I get it? It's nice to have a man's opinion. Then she goes to take an audible piss.
Uh-huh.
Open door, like straight up President Johnson. Mm-hmm. She President Johnsoned him.
Oh, yeah.
Like if he had taken a deuce, it would have been the only thing. She had taken a deuce, it would have been the only thing stronger.
No, it's fantastic.
She goes, look, like I got Israel back on board. And your president's going to invite us to Russia to meet face to face and work all this stuff out. And, oh, we're going to need that gay rights activist back. And by the way, hand me the towel, bitch.
Yeah.
Which she did.
And they rolled over, man. They rolled over immediately.
And they mentioned at the end of the episode that Frank, they're meeting in Russia, which I have a couple questions on. And also they are going to release Michael Corrigan during their visit, which mm-hmm. will be a major coup if it works out that way. However, can you see – what do you think is going to happen?
Wow. Yeah, Petrov is kind of an asshole, isn't he? It may not go as smoothly as they want it to. How about that?
I could see an inverse.
That's a non-specific prediction.
Where Frank goes with Claire and is super insulting. And, you know, but one of those things where it's like could be construed as just cultural differences. And then ultimately the Russian has some way to fuck him over with the press conference version. It's basically the inverse of what happened last time.
Could be.
He gives him a shitty surfboard. He hits on his, you know.
So that'll kind of tie the score, and then we'll see one final round.
Yeah. I don't know what Frank does. What's the equivalent of kissing his wife / putting a cigar out on his parking or on his garage exit? Is he going to fuck his mistress?
He's going to sing Korbaniki or whatever it is with all the wrong lyrics.
He's going to play Tetris during the dinner with the sound cranked to max.
I don't know, because it doesn't feel like this guy has anything that – like he's got to challenge his authority is what he has to do
in
front of people.
He kisses the president full on the mouth.
Sure, yeah.
No, I feel like he fucks a revenge fucks his mistress.
But who? It's a mistress. It's not like it's his wife.
Oh, it's still that fake Putin would take that as an insult.
You think so? All right.
Because it's you know, I think he would see that as like a property rights issue. I mean, I know that's offensive,
I
think it's meant to be seen as broadly offensive.
Okay, could be. I don't know.
I don't know. I don't either, but I kind of expect in an Alice in Wonderland through the looking glass version of the last meeting, which seems terrifically entertaining.
Sure. I've got a question for you.
Uh-huh.
Why do you think it is that Claire sleeps in that other bedroom?
That was my next bullet point.
Okay.
I don't know, because this was a throwback. Them sharing a cigarette in the Oval Office was a throwback to their, you know,
their brownstone window smokes.
Mm-hmm. And he talked about the fact that, you know, she says, I've never explained why I stayed in a different bed. And he's like, well, you said it's because it was cold. And he goes, well, it's not why I've stayed there. But then she never explains it.
I feel like it might be a subconscious thing for her, trying to separate herself a little bit from this first lady persona that she has. I mean, granted, it's not just a persona. It is, she's a first lady. But like, when she went into the UN, it kind of felt to me like she didn't want people to think of her as a first lady. Just kind of judge her on her own merits as a UN ambassador.
Okay. But she mentioned it wasn't because I don't love you or I've stopped loving you.
I think it was subconscious. Like, she didn't even realize necessarily why she was doing it.
Huh. There's got to be something more, though. And the fact that they left it open and he wasn't really interested in probing further has got to be... Hmm. I don't know. Maybe she fucks Petrov.
When? I mean,
in Russia.
Sneaking out.
In Russia.
Oh, she hasn't yet.
No.
But she will.
No.
Hmm. I suppose that could happen. I don't know.
I don't know why. Because
they just have to do it right.
He insulted her so much. I can't see her doing that. Like, even to get, because I don't think she's particularly angry at Frank either. He's done everything, sometimes against his better judgment, that she's wanted him to do. So that would feel more like a petty betrayal for no good reason. But I can't figure out. I can't figure out what they're trying to say. This also, we've never seen them actually have sex.
Yeah.
Until this season, mm-hmm. But this is the season that they're spending apart. Spending time apart in a bedroom.
Yeah.
And this is the season where neither one of them has like something on the side other than the threechum, which maybe they're partaking of, maybe they're not.
Uh-huh.
There's something about that. Like they're more physically intimate and more faithful to each other, but it somehow screwed up their dynamic. There's something there, but I don't know what it is.
This love stuff is getting in the way of our business. Jesus. Yeah, sure. No, I could totally see that.
Yeah.
There's something else there.
Next topic, and pretty much the only topic we got left to talk about, Doug.
Oh, yeah, Doug Stamper.
What is going on with Doug?
I feel like at this point the show has done enough to convince me and Heather Dunbar that Doug is on her side. I think when he trotted out that info about Claire's abortion, that was a true determining factor for me into his
motives. How does he... Okay, I'm going to read something from Aaron T here. He sent a feedback. He goes, he wants us to consider about what's going on with Doug. He goes, first, you got the straightforward scenario where Doug is fed up with Frank and honestly trying to work against him.
Mm-hmm.
While this is possible, I think we know there is more at play. Second scenario, off camera, Frank and Doug plan this out and he's working as a spy against Dunbar. The scenario is possible, but I do not personally think this is what's going on. Third scenario is his prediction. I think Doug is doing this to prove to Frank that he is back and is capable. Then, depending on what Frank does, Doug will either stick with Dunbar and use Rachel against Frank, or he will backstab Dunbar and kill Rachel.
It's a good plan. I like it.
So, to me, it's hard to walk back the abortion diary. Like, that is out, and it's in Frank's biggest enemy so far is hands.
Yeah.
How does Doug work that to Frank's favor? Now,
that's a fair question. I'm wondering if Doug knows enough about this woman to have 100% faith that she will never release that information because of all the reasons she gives right after he presents it to her. You know, as a woman, I would never do this to another woman.
But on the other hand, she also offered him formally a job. Like, to me, he's kind of exposing her for the same type of person that Frank is. Like, she says all this stuff, but when the push comes to shove, she's going to reach for the nuclear option. And maybe he will have gotten rid of it, burnt it by then. I don't know. I don't know how this is. There is something more here. I agree with Double Aaron T. I just don't know enough to read the tea leaves as yet.
Yeah.
The presidential race is heating up because Dunbar's really hitting the press. She's appearing with the gay rights activist husband and demanding that Frank do more, which is, you know, I always think it's interesting when an incumbent runs against a newbie, that the newbie can just savage the president on policy that the newbie has the new contender, the presidential hopeful.
Yeah.
There's like, you don't know what you can and can't do in the White House. So it's very easy to criticize a president for what he is or is not doing.
Sure.
Like it's extremely hard to, I mean, it's very easy to run against their record because you have none.
That's true. But at the same time, like as an outsider looking in on that, I also see that the president has a lot clearer idea of what he's talking about because he necessarily does. He's sure. The one making these policies with people. He's the one, who's in it day to day.
Sure.
So he's necessarily going to have more information and a better grasp on it. And I give him points for that. So I feel like in some ways in my head, at least it balances out.
How do you feel? Because we had, Meredith from The View was interviewing these. And we've seen Chris Matthews. We've seen Stephen Colbert. We've seen Wolf Blitzer on House of Cards. What's your opinion of real journalists taking part in fake journalism?
I don't really mind it. I think it lends a certain air of credibility to the show more than anything.
Yes, but what does it do to the credibility of the journalist? Because here's my perspective as a person who watches a lot of wonky news shows like Hardball, like, you know, I'll watch a lot of politics. Every time this comes up, they always like play the clip of them. And it's kind of like, you know, the way when we meet a celebrity, when we've gotten the privilege of meeting a few of them, and it's kind of like this, ooh, and you show off pictures and it's like you're bragging, but it's also kind of like weird that you're bragging that you met this famous person, and it kind of makes us look small time. There's something unseemly about these people. Like, look at this weird, crazy show that we're lending our legitimacy to for no journalistic integrity. It feels like a weird way of them selling out to me, and I don't like it. I don't like it.
Yeah, I don't feel that. I don't.
You don't watch these shows, though. You don't really, right?
That's true. Yeah, that's true.
I don't know. It bothers me.
But like when I see, I don't know, because I mean, I've seen obviously like John Oliver and stuff, and I've seen Jon Stewart and stuff.
That doesn't bother me nearly as much because they're fake journalists. That paradoxically are doing.
Colbert is, yeah.
So is Stewart.
But these guys are not fake journalists.
He's not. Yeah, Stewart would be the first to tell you that he's not a real journalist. He's there to entertain people. That's his mission statement. So Frank outlines the bait and switch with Jackie. So Jackie's going to run as a presidential hopeful and then to destroy Dunbar, presumably, and then to ultimately take one for the team and then become Frank's vice president. Okay, so fine. We finally get all that out. Do you think that her and Remy are actually on that playbook? Because they seem like they're up to something.
They do. I mean, we know that Jackie was the one who went to Ayla with information about Frank, so...
But that could all be part of the scheme.
It could be. I don't know where it fits in yet.
Frank seemed awful angry about the pit bull being replaced by the dragon for that to be... But then maybe again... See, it's like, how deep does this go? Is this a backdoor thing to get Doug back in because it's exposing Seth as a...
But how do you guarantee Ayla's reaction? How do you guarantee that she goes so over the top that you can justify pulling her credentials?
I don't know you judge future performance based on or future predictions based on past performance, right?
Okay, sure.
So she has been a firebrand pain in his side and he's just going to give her enough rope to hang herself and disgrace Seth. That lets Doug back. I don't know how much of this is architected and how much of this is just organically happening, but it makes me wonder.
But if he gets rid of Seth, Doug isn't Seth. Doug is Remy.
True. Doug is not Seth.
Does Remy take press secretary position? I don't know. He might be able to do it, I guess. I don't know why he wouldn't.
That would be the old team getting back together again.
Yes,
because at the start of the series, Remy was that position. He was the press secretary or the chief assistant.
I thought he was with the oil companies.
But I'm saying that like Frank talked about how he chose the money over power.
Oh, okay. The series even started.
And presumably Doug was with. So that's just kind of like his old war horses were Doug, Remy, and you know whatever his secretary, which we hadn't seen her.
No, we haven't.
Remember?
Not for a while.
Did she stick with the... Yeah, I can't remember where we left her in the last season.
I don't know.
She put up Rachel in season one, and I kind of lost track of her.
Yeah, me too.
Anyway, all this is to say, I don't get what's going on with her and Remy, because they're talking about her marrying this doctor and her adopting his two kids that I guess love her, and she loves the doctor, but she's also got the serious torch that she's holding for Remy. Remy seems to be holding the torch for her, which does not jive with my memory of their relationship last year.
Yeah, me either.
It seemed like, hey, you're a sexy person who's a politics or who's a power broker, and so am I. So let's fuck.
Yeah, that's what it seemed like to me. It doesn't seem to me that Jackie is as much worried about this as Remy is.
I don't know, man.
Jackie almost, it felt to me like she was telling him off a little bit.
Sure,
like,
but in previous
episodes. Check out this big fucking ring. Get out of my face.
In previous episodes, it seemed like she was gagging for him. And now it seems like she has turned the tables on him and made him jealous. But to what end? I don't understand.
I don't know. I don't know where the show's going with that.
Now, I could see them. So, like, this doctor seems like, first of all, they seem like they have a good sex life. They seem like their home life is good. Mm-hmm. And they seem like they genuinely like / love each other. And he's on board with being the politician's, like they've talked about, the expectations of being the mate of a politician.
Sure.
But Remy and Jackie seem more like Frank and Claire.
Yes.
Both good and bad.
Sure. I'd buy that.
So do you think that's what they're setting up?
Like the next generation of... Yeah. Scheming asshole.
Yeah. With a different male-female dynamic and all that. Yeah.
It could be. Why not? I'm sure somebody has to succeed Frank if he moves out of the picture.
Right. We also, in this race, we talked about the foreign policy expert who laid out the con side of Frank's long plan with this Jordan Valley, that if this blows up in his face, then you can say that, you know, he's made this disaster and foreign policy decision that's made the world a more dangerous place, and also put his inexperienced wife in charge to have this perfect storm that you can then take advantage of.
Yeah, no, it's bad news all around if this doesn't work.
Yeah. But anyway, we'll see what's going on with that. I
feel like Frank has set himself up in a position where all of these things have to work. And if they don't work, his entire career is over.
Yeah, it's not just any one of them comes through. It's like they all have to.
Yeah, every single thing has to work as planned.
And no one that he's counting on supporting him can betray him. When I see the seeds of betrayal in Doug and Jackie, mm-hmm. and honestly, it wouldn't surprise me if Claire backs, although he's been solid for her and she's been solid for him.
Yeah.
But she would backstab him if she thought that he was disloyal to her in some way.
Probably.
Anyway. That's all we got. We got a ton of feedback. That's the way these podcasts are going. We kind of do sprint and drifts where we record a couple episodes and we get a whole bunch of backlog of email. And then some, you know, when we record things back to back, we have a feedback deficit. But we got plenty this week. And I'm going to start from the top. Some of these are for 301, 302, and others. And then we got a few for this particular episode. Tiffany C. brings up something from the first episode that I wanted to talk about and I've forgotten to. I'm surprised about the very odd relationship between Doug Stamper and his brother. If I'm right, his brother flew in to take care of a sibling that he had not seen in a decade, and Stamper was not very gracious or appreciative. Mm-hmm. I think Stamper's obsession with Underwoods and his inflated sense of purpose in their lives will turn out to be his final undoing. They would have been fine with his death had he not left Rachel as a loose end, seeing as he knows so much about the wrongdoings that Frank has committed. Some may have found it a bore, but I find Stamper's obsession with the Underwoods very interesting. Do you think that Frank will get Doug drunk and carbon monoxide it up in the garage before the end of the season? There's a lot of parallels there between Pete, recovering alcoholic.
Yeah, no, for sure. I could totally see that happening. Yeah. Mm. Especially if he tries to expose the Rachel stuff mm-hmm. for the benefit of Dunbar.
Is that too on the nose, Pete, for you, or is that acceptable? Because that's if it goes down that way, that's essentially Pete would be the original Death Star and Doug would be the Death Star too. You got the trench run, you blow it up, you party with Ewoks, and you're done.
What if Doug does something like that to Frank?
Ooh.
Turn it around.
But Frank doesn't have that kind of vice. Like, Frank's downfall will be external, not internal, I don't think.
Yeah, you're probably right. He seems to have a fairly good command of himself as a person.
Like, Pete's self-destructed, that's what allowed Frank to murder him, essentially. Yeah. Of course, Frank helped a lot. Anyway, I thought that was interesting. Oscar A said, I wanted to ask if you think there's anyone politically motivated in the show that is a clear-cut for or against the Underwoods at this point. It seems to me everyone is so gray or vindictive enough to switch sides, and Jackie's play made me think that I'm on to something. I have no idea if she knows how to back the right side or not.
Are you talking major like players in the plot, or are you talking like, because the Democratic and the Republican Party both hate him in the House?
Yeah, name one person he can solidly count on. Claire?
Claire.
That's it.
I feel like maybe Seth is in that camp as well.
I don't know. Seth stepped in it with the dragon business.
He did.
And he's more of a mercenary anyway.
Is he?
Like, he was never Doug is just loyal. He is a soldier.
But now he's apparently flip-flop.
But that's after a long time of either Frank deliberately trying to alienate him and or long conning a way to get, I mean, like I said, I don't, that's still yet to come.
Yeah.
Remy is a little mixed up here with the Jackie thing. I don't ever buy Seth as entirely loyal. There's nobody he's got, really.
This show's got you paranoid.
Donald Bly certainly isn't. You know, his vice president hates him and is being schemed actively against. Mm-hmm. Supreme Court's pissed off at him. He's got nothing.
Yeah, so many people are actively angry at this guy at this point.
The mayor of D.C. seems to love Frank Underwood.
You're right.
That's it.
Yep.
Mayor of D.C. for president. Les S. had some thoughts on the eggs. He said, the number one, the Frank egg was the black one with both the presidential and first lady seals. There was a definite effort to identify this egg as black, which must be significant. Does black mean death? At the end, Claire puts two eggs in a frying pan, possibly representing the two of them. Does this represent both Claire and Frank being cooked, meaning they end up either actually dead or two having their careers destroyed?
Yeah, totally could. I like that.
On Frank not seeking nomination, Frank said he did not seek the Democratic nomination in 2016. With all he is doing to seemingly undermine the Democratic Party, the drone strike issue, etc., could he actually flip the script and run as a Republican? He didn't say he wasn't running at all. It's not like he's above this level of betrayal.
Because those are only two options. Look, people, he can run if he wants to run, if he has the money, right?
But do you think he could somehow get on Mendoza's side and offer him the VP spot and switch? That's like, there's no way.
I think these guys are just so pissed at him for being a manipulative asshole in the first place. They would recognize it, A, and B, even if they didn't, they would never go along with him on anything.
Yeah, but these are guys saying, you guys strong-armed me this one time and you're not going to do it again. Like, okay, that's a challenge. I don't. Steve from Florida also co-signed this guy. He came up with it independently, but Les got it in first, said the same thing about running as Republican. That almost never happens. Like, sometimes you'll have an independent who is, you know, either a liberal or conservative, and independent sheep declare one way or another, or you'll have a Democrat like Lieberman declared as an independent, kind of as a fuck you to his own party. Mm-hmm. But a president switching, a sitting president? I don't even know if that's I don't even know that that's constitutional. With the fact that the president is still the one position that's still not a democracy, it's representative, mm-hmm. it's electoral. Mm-hmm. So you're not really voting for a man, you're voting for the party's nomination. I don't know what the hell that would happen if a sitting president said, now if he
could run as something else.
If he says, I'm not
right?
seeking re-election, I'm running as a Democrat. Yeah, yeah, I guess he could do that. Man, that would be gonzo crazy.
It would be. That's too far?
Well, I'm just saying that, like, the Democrats aren't going to, I mean, just on principle, Democrats out there are going to vote for you.
Yeah.
And Republicans would be deeply skeptical of you switching sides.
Uh-huh.
Anyway.
And not to mention the public. I mean, how are you going to get votes?
That's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the people.
I thought you meant within the Congress and the Senate.
Yeah. Curry McKay said, I did want to speculate on the Claire cracked eggs theory.
Okay.
It's probably a callback to her inclinations toward motherhood in earlier seasons, or could it be? Like, in the wake of her being voted down, she's realizing that her first ladyship doesn't afford her the power she thought she might have, and that she's just given up the possibility of having children for a position that isn't garnering her the opportunities she thought it might. Additionally, I think that if they wanted it purely as an omelet metaphor, she would have made an actual omelet. The fried egg thing seemed to evoke an egg, emphasis on egg wordplay. I don't know, because Claire seems like she is not interested in being a mother just on her own own Steam, and that was the mistake the photographer made. Like, he underestimated her as a person and thought that a lot of the stuff was Frank's desires and not her own.
Yeah, I think you're right.
But I thought they were interesting. Moving on to Glenn B. said, this is a question from the very end of the episode for chapter 28 about the lawsuit by the man whose family was killed in a drone strike. Here's how I understand it, and even with a degree in political science and a solid decade of being a legal nerd since, I'm only like 80% sure it's correct, so take this with a huge grain of salt. The man, whose name escapes me, is suing the government civilly for monetary damages, presumably for wrongful death, pain and suffering, and medical expenses to make for his own injuries, rather. The Solicitor General is defending the U.S. government in this case, which has arisen presumably through a series of appeals to the Supreme Court, which is, of course, her job. Her recommended legal strategy has been to evoke executive privilege, that is to say that the executive branch doesn't need to answer any questions about the drone strike, which deprives the plaintiff of any evidence that the U.S. government was responsible. This is a rip from the headlines sort of gambit, as this was a drone strike lawsuit against the U.S. government dismissed in real life on this exact same basis. And he linked me an article on Yahoo News about this lawsuit being dismissed about the drone strikes. He says, Frank decided instead to declassify the intelligence and operation. This is legal and a prerogative as the chief executive. What the Solicitor General meant by saying it wasn't the most sound legal strategy is kind of like a lawyer advising a criminal defendant that confessing to the crime is unsound legal strategy. The president can do what he does, but it might increase the likelihood of the court ruling against them in this case, depending on what they think of the executive branch's rationale for the strike.
So he's putting everything on the table, right? Like, literally all of his chips are in. His freedom at the end of this might be in on the table.
I don't
table.
Know about that. Like,
I mean, if he's breaking laws, I...
But he's not.
Well, that's to be argued, isn't it? Like, that's what they're going to decide, whether or not what he did...
It seems like the case is whether the government owes this man a settlement.
Oh, really? Okay.
For a response, not like it's a war crime or something like that. It hasn't risen to that. But okay. Your point is well taken. He's not just pushing all his chips. He's playing five hands of poker simultaneously and pushing all his chips in on all five games.
Sure, sure.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's wild. I like it.
Kelly S. has an interesting point on the Doug syringe issue. Said one reason Doug may be using a syringe is to avoid the physical sensation, the experience of alcohol moving over his lips. Based on the scenes with his obsession with Rachel Sheets in season 2, I'd say that sensory experiences are very important to him. Also, the sensation of being read to also applies to this theory. Likely the sensory experience of the vodka going over his lips, or in the bourbon in this case, would only intensify the longing for his old ways. By shooting the vodka into his mouth, he denies himself that pleasure. In that way, he maintains the delusion he's denying himself something he once could not live without.
Okay. I could buy that.
I don't think this changes our thoughts on the matter, but it adds some nice color to it.
Sure, definitely.
So I like that. Jay from Memphis said, I was listening to the podcast for season 3, episode 2, and Aaron discussed why putting $500 billion into a one-to-one expenditure by hitting full employment would be advantageous politically. Here's the implicit reason why, aside from a generally offering employment. Number one, the multiplier effect. You can Wikipedia if you prefer, but but he's going to kind of outline it for us. Essentially, putting money into hands of someone going from an income of zero to a solid wage pumps money into the economy at a faster rate than most purely public expenditures. The reasons being, A, everyone takes care of their needs first. That means paying for food, housing, and utilities. B, the next step is modest discretionary luxuries. There's a whole subset of the economy related to this, including podcast subscriptions. He notes parenthetically, join Club Bald Move for all your audio treadmill needs.
Yes, thank you for that ad.
C, both of the above pump money into the regular arteries of the economy. In turn, that feeds other businesses. The goal is to directly send a single dollar bill through to market as many times as possible after immediate payment. D, alternatively, that money might be spent developing tanks or dogfighting airplanes. That expenditure is larded out by the time it hits people's pockets, meaning it doesn't circulate as well or as frequently. So in addition to hiring people, America Works would probably make the U.S. very attractive for foreign investment. Stock prices would go up from individual institutional investors. Public investments and mutual funds and pensions would increase the strength of any enterprise by improving the underlying infrastructure. The downside is that complete melding of state and industry is the definition of fascism. So there's that.
You know, just that.
He says, anywho, I'm not sure how a program like AmWorks, as proposed, would play out in actuality. It doesn't imply an authoritarian vanguard forcing compliance and acceptance of an idea, but it doesn't rule it out either. However, millions of people could probably peacefully and fruitfully, if redundantly and or unprofitably, be employed. Considering that money once collected will not be immediately reimbursed, putting it in the hands of people rather than a largely institutionalized shareholders would keep every crisp dollar bill snapping through the market in perhaps the fastest way possible for public expenditure.
Okay. I'm even less of an economist than he is.
Yes.
So
that's
sure.
The thing I have. Like I've really struggled in the last few years to understand economics on a global political basis.
Okay.
And I read that and that seems to make sense. But then I read conservative think pieces that talk about, you know, or liberal ones that make the opposite case. And that makes sense, too.
Sure.
And I'm like, God damn it. What is real? What is real when it comes to finance and politics and money, monetary policy?
You won't get an answer from me. That's for sure.
Chris C. said, it's quite the coincidence that Boris Nemtsov, the leading critic of Putin, was just murdered in the Red Square on February 27th at the same time this season was hitting Netflix. I have to wonder how long ago this season's arc was pinned, considering everything that's happened with Russia in the last few months. It is prescient.
Yeah, definitely.
Like Dan Carlin was writing about poking the Russian bear like 8 months ago before it kind of like, you know, before the Olympics and before it really blew up.
Mm-hmm.
But damn, this show is like ripped from the headlines.
Yeah. Yeah. They must. I don't know. I mean, they shot it, what, several months ago?
Had to have.
So I don't know. Maybe they have a lot of people reading and who understand this shit and just say, what is the most pertinent issue right now?
Yeah.
As relates to the plot that we kind of want to tell.
I can't think of anything like it. Like, there's been a lot of, you know, post 9/11, post Mideast foreign policy movie and entertainment made in hindsight.
Yeah.
But this is like real time criticism, and or commentary. And it's kind of exciting and also grim.
Yeah, it is that.
Like, I'm deriving entertainment from something that's genuinely a complex and scary thing going on in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
He continues, we know how Frank performs against people who are playing the same game as him. I'm very excited to see how he fares up against someone who is an entirely different rule book. On the whole, I think the Russian arc will be more interesting than the Chinese one from season two. At the very least, I think more viewers will have been exposed to the headlines they're ripping the story from. I wish there was going to be more seasons solely so that Doug could be killed and resurrected every year as a growingly disfigured, syringe-sipping Frankenstein's monster. Got to go with the bolts, man.
Yeah.
Get the bolts in the neck next.
Now, if I don't see bolts in two episodes, I'm out.
Final email, which actually pertains to this episode, from Amy from Oxford, England.
Okay.
Said, I wanted to pause to express how badass and brilliant I thought the restroom scene between Claire and Alexei was in episode 5. Given the previous exchange between the two earlier in the episode, I really thought this encounter played with gender politics and patriarchal power in a really interesting way that I haven't seen before. Mm-hmm. I will co-sign that.
Yeah.
In their earlier conversation, Alexei called Claire out on her inability to make an impact, making a misogynist jibe about her being only good first lady material, and then belittling her by snidely complimenting her dress, which is classic sexist moves to reduce a woman to nothing more than her appearance.
To be fair, it was an awesome dress.
To be fair.
That's a pretty nice dress.
Cut to the next scene together, and the angle and tone of their relationship completely changes when Alexei is forced into a feminine-centric situation that makes him feel hilariously uncomfortable and takes him out of the perception of females with which he feels confident.
Yep.
Being in a woman's restroom and having to witness the pee flow of a prominent, powerful female reduces him to an awkward mess, and the choice of location and deliberate action from Claire makes the punch of her miracle dealings even more of a bloody blow for him. Body blow, rather. We as viewers already know that Claire is certainly no fair damsel, but I thought this whole scene was a great twist on the chauvinist getting his comeuppance trope that is so often used in drama. Probably my favorite scene of the entire season so far.
It was
a great
good.
Scene.
Real good, yeah.
And I think as a lady, you very well articulated why it hit.
Yeah, much better than I could do.
It's great. I can foresee some more Emmy nominations for Robin Wright based on her work thus far, and we're not even done.
The best bathroom scene?
I want to see that on the Emmy cast. I want her sitting on the toilet with the door open, haranguing Alexei. That's her submission episode.
Awesome.
I want to hear audible peeing on Emmy night. Okay. If you'd like to send some more feedback, you can do so at houseofcards@baldmove.com. Also, I got a forum threads, which I'll probably be trolling for the next episode, where everything's broken down by episode and subject matter. You can get in there on forums.baldmove.com. Of course, every episode gets posted to Facebook, the facebook.com/baldmove. You can discuss it there. You can annoy Jim and harass him on Twitter @baldmove. Also, keep up with our release schedule.
You really hit that annoy and harass button every time.
I know.
Like, yeah, go over there, give him shit. Give him plenty of shit.
Well, you know, that's the peril me do 99.9% of the outros. You should...
It's not really working, though. People aren't giving me enough shit.
Come on, people.
What's going on?
You're daring me to come back on the Twitter because I can do that for you.
Sure. Sounds good. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back next time. Until then, I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron. See ya.